Thanks, Tom. Thanks the organizers for letting me to talk a bit today about BSM searches and results from the first run two data. So I guess I'd be remiss in any BSM talk to not at least mention briefly the DiPhoton. So this is all old news by now, including updates presented at Morion. I think one of the interesting things that obviously has been discussed out of this is that I think if you'd taken a survey 10 years ago of what to expect, most people would have said some form of new physics that looked like SUSY, and I suppose that this could be it, but if so, it certainly isn't the kind of SUSY most of us were expecting, although Nathaniel gave a nice summary talk of this and pointed out that there have been some creative efforts to fit it into our preferred SUSY models. But one of the nice things about it that has generated so much discussion is that it's easy to write down a pretty simple generic model for the diphotons that just introduces some new colored or charged particles running through the loops. Of course, this gives us new things to search for, and then many of the signatures that you may expect you'd want to look for if these objects were there are already being looked for, and we have some results with the 2015 data looking at exactly this, things like vector-like fermions and other partners of the quarks. No evidence for any excess here, and already they push the boundaries beyond what we could say with run one. And while I think we're all of course, just waiting for the next few months to hopefully bring some clarity to the situation with the diphotons, it may take a bit more time if it's real to find out if it really has some friends that it's bringing along with us. But one thing that I think has been clear is that it's certainly been quite a social phenomena. There's been a lot of time and creativity devoted to postulating about what it might be, and Alessandro had this timeline of the number of papers written on the topic up to March. There were 260, and there was this paper that appeared around then that posited we'd get no more than 310 by the summer, but it looks like it's already the first victim to fall is there's closing in on 400 as of yesterday morning. It's okay, it's in good company because there'll surely be more by summer's end or the end of the year. But okay, so that's I think all I wanted to say about the diphotons. So what I will and won't cover today, I was guided to target about 30 minutes, so I can't possibly target everything, and thankfully I don't have to. Daniel will cover quite a bit in the next talk. But using this now ubiquitous figure as kind of a guide to what might be interesting, sort of things with a mass scale below about 1.5 TeV, things like weak production, Higgs, light resonances, generally we won't have anything interesting to say with just a few inverse femtobarns. So I'll focus mostly on cases where we can potentially say something, strong production. And so as a result, this talk will mostly be a talk about SUSY. And I should say that when I say SUSY, what I really mean is searches for new physics where MET is an important distinguishing characteristic of the events. Now this of course ignores at least half of SUSY, and I won't talk at all about RPV searches, even though there have been quite a few interesting results on them lately from both ATLAS and CMS. But these tend to have more in common with Exotica or Exotics, as Tom told me ATLAS prefers. So, such as searches for hadronic resonances, multi-jet final states, and then I think Daniel will tell us all about this in the next talk, so I won't say any more about those types of searches. Perhaps one other caveat I should give before moving on. There's a whole class of searches where MET is the sort of the distinguishing characteristic that I'm going to completely ignore here, and that's searches for dark matter. It's not that there haven't been some preliminary results put out on it, but it's more that fundamentally they have the same signatures as most of the SUSY searches we perform, and thus they confront the same issues for background estimates, interpretations, et cetera. And really, I guess this is expected. At a basic level, the searches for SUSY that we've been performing for a decade or two were already dark matter searches, so It's no surprise also then that they also tend to have similar sensitivity for these signatures. And finally, I'll just give the disclaimer that basically all of the results that I'll talk about today are, of course, the searches are performed by both Atlas and CMS, but since I'm on CMS, I'm more familiar with those results, so most of the results in the talk will be from CMS. Not because they're any better or different, really, just I know them better. Okay. Of course, the Suzy convener says that. All right, so we're all familiar with this. This is kind of where the searches stood at the beginning of 2015. But I think if we look at this, it kind of gives a guide as to what we can expect in the early stages of run two. I've sort of drawn a line around this mass scale for a Spartacle. To the left, we don't really expect to be able to say a whole lot so far, and to the right, we expect to be able to say something new and potentially interesting. And so this sort of did guide the way the searches got organized. Many of the results that we have so far come from inclusive searches for multi-jet, one lepton final states, probing sort of high mass colored SUSY partners, and also some targeted searches for third generation, where we're sort of right at the boundary of where we might be able to say something interesting. But also the great disparity in mass scales between what we can say about weakly produced particles versus, let's say, partners of the gluon also sort of guide us to expect that we want to design searches that can cover very broadly a range of signatures and masses. And so rather than just put up a bunch of results, I thought I'd first go through a bit of what is one of these inclusive searches look like, what are some of the challenges that they pose, and so what can we already learn with the 13 TeV data, and what questions can we ask with it. So from the last slide, we saw that we want to choose selections that cover a broad range of signatures. This is both in the invisible energy scale as well as the visible, and there are half dozen or more of these searches between CMS and Atlas. They make use of variables that have, you know, lots of M's and subscripts in it. But ultimately, these things kind of all look and perform fairly similarly, and they're designed to try to be sensitive to and probe physics with an unknown mass scale and an unknown mass splitting. Some of the types of things that we look for, you know, are final states that range anywhere from having, say, two colored objects plus invisible energy in the final state, all the way up to sort of very spectacular four top plus MET signatures that we're now all familiar with. And as a result of this, we also then want to design the searches to sort of be very inclusive in parton multiplicity. So a new feature in some of the CMS analyses, like maybe the final merging of the dark matter and SUSY searches, is that the SUSY searches now have added monojet bins to them, and the dark matter searches have added everything more than one, so these now look quite similar. At the same time, of course, then we also want to be sensitive to a variety of flavor content that could appear, both in terms of distribution of jets arising from B quarks, but also employing more sophisticated methods like top tagging and other hadronic resonances. And so the totality of wanting to be sensitive then to all of this leads inevitably to designing a search that tries to cover the full phase space that's permitted by the triggers. And so what this means is a very broad range of HT, that is the scalar sum of the jet energy that ranges from as low as 200 on up, with, you know, splitting it up into a few regions to probe different mass scales. And similarly, probing a variety of scales of the invisible energy, whether it's MET or in the example I'm using here, MT2. And similarly then splitting up the plane in terms of the number of reconstructed jets and those identified coming from heavy flavor. And all of this kind of being done in a way that's designed to probe some corner of the standard model phase space, so that you kind of see that we start in regions dominated when you have small multiplicity by Zs and Ws, and then as you increase it, probing really tails of top quark pair production. The search I show here as an example has 172 search regions, which already becomes pretty difficult to wrap one's mind around, and of course some have a factor of a few more or a factor of a few less, but ultimately they all kind of are facing the same challenges. So in the case of a JET plus MET search, we know the major backgrounds come from things like pair production of bosons Z's and W's, where the Z decays to neutrinos, or that the W decays leptonically, and so that there's real MET from the neutrino, but for some reason we lose the lepton in the event. Either it's out of acceptance or not isolated. And some background that comes from QCD multi-jet production, where one or more of the jets in the event is mismeasured. And really all of the searches employ a similar strategy, which is develop some tool that allows you to suppress this to the level where you think it's negligible, and then deal with the remaining. And I'll just talk about one of them as an example of how we go about doing this and what some of the maybe the challenges are that we face in the coming years. So looking at the invisible Z, okay, this is, we all know, produces Z in association with some jets. The Z decays to neutrinos. These jets are all coming from initial state radiation, and we don't want to rely on simulation entirely to describe this out into far tails. But we can take advantage of the fact that the production properties for W's and Z's and photons are all pretty similar. And so, for example, we can select photon events, remove the photon to mimic the Z, and then apply some well-understood corrections. Here you see the PT spectrum for Z's and photons as a function of the boson PT. And once the momentum becomes sufficiently large that we get away from effects of the Z mass, this ratio becomes pretty flat, and it's a very useful way to estimate this background. Now how the details of how it's actually done change quite a bit from search to search. But fundamentally, there's two major components. I mean, one is we have to be able to take some factor that tells us how to turn the observed photon count into Z's. And typically, one of the reasons we use photons is there's about twice the number of photons as there is Z's. So that's sort of the translation factor. And many of the searches will devise control regions such that they exactly match up with the signal region selection except for the presence of the photon. And then we can ask, well, how sensitive are we to higher order corrections to this ratio of Z to photons, because we often take this from leading order Monte Carlos. Alternately, if we want to try to reduce the large uncertainty that can come from the photon control sample at very high, for example, boson PT, where we're really probing the tails, we can instead estimate it in an inclusive way, and then we have to rely on simulation to extrapolate in the boson PT, and there we're sensitive to similar questions. How well do we model this boson PT? How sensitive are we to effects that we're not accounting for? Of course, this is checked in data using both photons and W's, and all right, the statistics are pretty poor with only 200 receptive arms, but if you squint, maybe you can imagine there's a slight slope here that slopes downwards. And all right, is this evidence for the data falling faster than the Monte Carlo? Are there corrections we're missing that we naively get wrong just relying on leading order estimates? Well, maybe. I mean, certainly it tells us to expect quite a significant change in shape from both next to leading order and electroweak effects. And I think we'll see in the coming year just how big of an effect this is for the searches, but there's already a lot of effort thanks to the next generation Monte Carlos and close collaboration with the theoretical community to include all these effects in the searches, and I expect we'll see them included everywhere by the end of the year. All right, but that's one of the background estimates. The others all face similar types of questions. But as we all know by now, we've looked in many places, and as Tom said, there's something like 4,000 plots, and none of them are very interesting because they don't show anything new. So no evidence for non-standard model physics either in the one I chose here or in any of the others with the 2015 data. And of course, then we turn these into the plots that actually get shown around much more. All of these exclusion curves on various scenarios of SUSY partner production. Here's summary plots from CMS for a wide variety of inclusive searches for final states with light flavored quarks, bees, and tops. And I think the immediate thing that jumps out is that there's a lot of lines and they all kind of lie in pretty much the same place. So the searches all do about equally well. They probe gluino masses anywhere from 1.5 to a bit over 1.7 TeV, depending on details. And then there's some of the obvious trends we've already seen in the past, right? We tend to do better when there's bees present than when there aren't, and better in scenarios where there's a few hard objects than when there's many more soft ones. And we see this both in the reach at the high mass end, comparing these two, for example, as well as sort of how compressed can we go? How high of LSP mass can we probe? Now, I talked a bit in these past few slides about sort of the CMS approach, and I think it's worth an interesting to contrast with the search that's employed by Atlas. First thing that you notice is all the bins can fit in one table. There's just, for example, this is a search for final states with three or more bees, and there's only three search regions. And the search regions are not necessarily exclusive. And yet, to go ahead, they do the same interpretations. And I think the first thing that jumps out, and probably is the number that most people read from these, is that this line at the high mass end is in the same place. So you can do just as well, it looks like, with the simple one bin as you can with 172. So you may ask, well, why bother with 172 then? And there is some difference. One of the features you notice is that this curve kind of flattens out and stays flat the entire way, while the curves on the left tend to reach the slightly larger LSP masses. So you can then debate, is it worth the extra 171 bins to achieve some extra space here in the top? And I think that's something that we can discuss. And then you can also ask, which of these is the better way to actually go about discovering new physics if it exists, and that's probably also a separate interesting discussion. But I think it.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
You are comparing ATV and 20 TV data.
I think this is. Sorry, do you want to?
It looks to me that in the two plots you're comparing 8 TeV and 13 TeV data, so it's just a coincidence that they're in the same place, right?
No, I think it's just a little confusing maybe the way it's labeled, but the only the gray band.
Oh, sorry,
right,
sorry. Okay, the yellow one is 8 TeV. It's 13, sorry, yeah.
Right.
Okay, thanks. So.
But since you pointed out, one of the things that you already notice here is that there's this very large improvement in reach as you go from 8 to 13 TeV, and I think maybe that's the more interesting place to start asking questions. How does our sensitivity change from 8 to 13 TeV? What can we learn from it? So here's an example of, again, this final state with many bees and large invisible energy. And I've overlaid a 8 TeV result within the 13 TeV, and okay, similarly as on the previous slide, you see a large increase in sensitivity at the low mass end. This was, of course, the expected gain that we got from the increase in collision energy. But you also notice that even at much lower masses, we get a very large increase in sensitivity in terms of the reach for the LSP mass. And so I think it's natural to ask where that comes from. And so if you look here on the right, I've put for one of the CMS searches a distribution of the various search regions in terms of from left to right increasing HT with all of the many binnings and number of jets and BTAG jets. And what you see is that even though the signal here, I chose a point where the mass splitting between the gluino and LSP is pretty small. So what that means is that mass splitting is driving the momentum of those jets. So we tend to get fairly soft jets in the event. And yet, we find that most of the signal that gives us our sensitivity actually lies at pretty large values of HT. So in effect, what's happening is that because the sensitivity is coming from higher HT bins, it's getting there from having high PT ISR. And thus, we're really effectively probing some larger root S hat process, and thus we get a much larger cross-section enhancement than we may have naively expected from the mass of this particle alone. Another interesting thing that jumps out from this plot, though, is that the The bare process, we would expect at most four jets possibly to come from the bees. And given that as we go towards the diagonal and things become compressed, these bees become soft, we probably don't even find all of them. So we only get maybe two or three of them. Yet a lot of the signal is falling in bins that require at least seven jets, which means we're getting three, four, five extra jets coming from somewhere else. Mostly initial state radiation, and I think it would give us pause then, do we really trust results that would come predominantly from so many ISR jets? And so we did take a closer look at this, put an ordering here of the regions that give us the most sensitivity to one of these points in the compressed region. And it's a bit comforting to see that while the HT bins tend to be fairly moderate to high, most of the places we get sensitivity from actually have fairly small jet multiplicity. So we're not relying too much on ISR beyond to give us the initial kick to the system to have a significant invisible energy.
Can you say something about how you're simulating
the signal? Sure. The signals here are, all right, so the matrix elements generated leading order MAD graph with up to two extra partons and then matched to Pythia, and we allow Pythia to do the decays of this particles. Well, so again, with these hundreds of bins that the searches take now, I mean, this is a bin that only requires one. These require exactly two, and there's some that are three or more. But right, you see a lot of the sensitivity, as you may have expected, when the bees are softer, we don't pick up all of them, so it tends to come from lower multiplicity. And this probably also contributes to some of the difference in sensitivity near the diagonal versus the interpretation we saw, which is predominantly multi-B versus having lower B multiplicity in this kind of search. Okay, but that was quite a bit about gluinos and gluon partners. The picture for the partners of the quarks is not so different. Here's a CMS showing results from multiple searches. Now that we're getting into the third generation partners, which we saw were kind of right on the boundary of where we would have something interesting to say with early data, you can see three of the targeted searches here. The sensitivity reaches to about the same boundary as we got at 8 TeV. We're pushing up towards about 800 GeV in stop mass. Another interesting feature from the plot on the right, though, is that also overlaid are two curves from these inclusive searches that kind of just bin up face space into many bins. And we see that they actually perform basically the same as the targeted searches, which may be a bit surprising. And you may ask, why do the targeted searches then? But I think one of the first things that's already come up is these inclusive searches really aren't so generic anymore. They're now chopping up this phase space into so many bins that they can collect the signal over a broad range of multiplicities and a broad range of visible and invisible energy. And as a result, they can have sensitivity to a wide range of signatures that they weren't necessarily designed or targeted for from the outset. At the same time, with so little data, the targeted searches really aren't that targeted yet because you can only be so aggressive with two inverse femtobarns and still have any signal left. And so you can see, for example, the targeted one lepton search from CMS where there's nine bins in contrast to the 172 that we were comparing it to. So I think there's two lines of thinking here for how this will move forward in the future. Either the targeted searches need to be much more aggressive in the future in order to be able to say something significantly different than the inclusive searches. Or you can argue, well, it's going to be really hard to convince anyone that you've seen anything new when you have 172 bins. And so the simplicity on the left is really a virtue, and you shouldn't change it. You should keep doing it the way it is, and they complement one another. All right, so that covers the major set of new results in terms of signatures with MET. And so I think for the last few minutes, it's natural to ask a bit, what does the future look like? I mean, much of the gain that we get from going to higher beam energy has been or already will soon be realized. Certainly for many of the searches I presented by the end of 2016, they'll They'll move into the slow regime of just improving cross-section upper limits with increasing luminosity. So as this happens, I think that the transitions is already starting to and will continue to move to weak production or searching for more specific signatures, compressed spectra, and there's some combination of these. And while there already was a large program of weak production searches in run one, and sort of that will sort of continue on the well-beaten path for the next year or two, I think there's a few other cases that are interesting to look at. So Atlas made this really nice plot showing what happens to our sensitivity as the decays change and become more complicated. So for example, they took a variety of scenarios, just sort of the generic case that has been considered for a long time, where you get sort of four high PT jets in the event and met, and then start adding intermediate states that dilute this so that you get a larger multiplicity of softer objects. And so that's sort of, for a hadronic search, that moves you from this pink curve to the red curve, and you see that at the high end there's little difference, but you already start to lose some at the compressed end as things become softer. And then you move to the green, and now as you add two intermediate states, you start to see that the loss becomes much larger. So one direction that the analyses are already moving in for 2016 is, can you take advantage of these extra steps in the decay? Can you look for hadronic resonances, Higgs to BB bar, or WZs and TOPS? A lot of these tools have already been used in some form in the exotic searches, but are fairly new to sort of the searches with large MET that are traditionally SUSY. And finally, the compressed spectra is a topic that's already getting lots of discussion. I mean, in the signature, really, compressed spectra meaning something like dark matter that has just initial state radiation, or something where the decay products tend to be very soft. In one of the cases of most interest for this is the corridor area where in stop pairs, where the mass splitting is about the top mass. And you may have noticed earlier that at least in all the CMS plots, there's a big white line going through this. This sort of was a decision we took because we weren't really comfortable that we understood answers to all the questions needed to make statements about this region. And I think some of the questions maybe make an interesting list of things to think about as we move forward. So as we try to push what we can say about compressed spectra, we become sensitive to very far tails of the distribution and to ISR. So do we really understand the performance of our background estimates well enough in this regime to trust them? Do we understand the transfer factors that we get often from simulation in this regime? Also, more on the side of actually interpreting our results as limits in on these models, where does the sensitivity to compressed spectra come from? I mean, much of it derives from very far tails of either kinematic or multiplicity distributions, high PT ISR, high ISR multiplicity. For example, in the top corridor that I mentioned on the previous slide, many of the regions that have sensitivity here have acceptances that are of the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. Do we really trust the simulation to get things right at that level? And not just the modeling of the physics correctly, but I mean, where else we should ask, where else does the signal actually come from? For example, in a JET plus MET search, how much of it is actually not JET plus MET events at all, but is actually events with one or more leptons, and we lost the leptons? Do we trust the modeling of that? How important is the signal contamination, and are we accounting for it correctly? And at the level of 10 to the minus 4, we start to become sensitive to, as Matt was asking earlier, you know, how important are differences in how we generate our signal and background? We don't generate them with the same number of partons or the same generator or the exact same configuration. Are we exploiting some weird features in the simulation that aren't real to gain our sensitivity? In CMS, we also use a simplified simulation. How much of our sensitivity is just coming because we don't actually use the same detector simulation? And finally, most of the focus on the compressed spectra up to now has come primarily from monojet and sort of multi-jet ISR signatures, but what about other production mechanisms? For example, is VBF a tool that we can exploit to also say something about these compressed SUSY scenarios? And what about other information from the decays? It's very soft, but perhaps we can take advantage of experiment's ability to go down to few GeV leptons and try to exploit this as a handle to, say, suppress the very large invisible Z background. So I think that there's exciting times ahead and a lot of work to do. This run has really just begun, and it's a run that's really about exploration and discovery. And I think the increase in beam energy and then the large data sets that we hope that we get soon give us reason for optimism. And perhaps we're already glimpsing a first sign of what the future may look like. So I think stay tuned, and we'll see what the summer holds in store for us.
Can you go to slide 18? I guess ask this question on many slides, but on 18 I think is the one where I got most confused first. So if I look at the far left plot there, each one of those colored lines corresponds to a multiply binned search, right?
That's
and the
correct.
Only and the difference between them is in some sense what variable I'm using to slice up parameter space?
In part, right. So there's two main differences, I'd say, between them in terms of the slicing of phase space. One has to do with a different choice, typically in the variable that kind of characterizes the invisible energy in the event. And the other is that the binnings are not all the same. So some searches go all the way down to, for example, down to including events with one jet. Others only include events with five jets or more. So there is a difference in the region of phase space that's probed, but they go ahead and interpret all of these scenarios anyway.
I mean, I guess the question is, it's actually a fairly large range between those different methods, and how much of that difference should I attribute to the term in parentheses, whether it's MT2 versus Razor versus Alpha T versus some other aspect of the analysis that's not being shown? Because it's pretty large range between the green and the yellow.
Right. So right. If we compare the expected curves, it's 200 GeV, say, which is pretty sizable.
And I mean, how should I conceptualize
right.
where that difference
so
is coming from?
I don't think the differences don't really come, I'd say, from the different choices of variable to characterizing visible energy. They come more from other choices in the analysis design, whether the multiplicity that's used, how the bins are chopped. For example, one of them, this pink one, I think its highest multiplicity bin is just greater than or equal to 4, so it doesn't probe as far into the tails. So there's differences like this that are, I think, much more responsible for the disparity you see between the curves, and that's in part because they've sort of aimed to target different regions they think are interesting. But I think Claudia wants to say something.
So in this particular case, the main difference is that some of the analysis were just targeting initially Gluino production, so that higher jet multiplicity, and it didn't go far down in lower jet multiplicity. And then another one, like Alpha T, decided that for the 13 TV data, they would be very, very aggressive in killing QCD, which meant killing efficiency as well. So this is part of the complementarity of having these different approaches.
So in the context of compressed spectrum or in the context of electroweak production, getting the spectrum of extra hard or medium hard jets is obviously a key issue. So from the point of view of standard model studies of questions of this type, are there studies that we should be paying attention to, or ones that might be in the pipeline that are going to be important tests that will feed into the Monte Carlos and tests of calculations and so forth?
Well, so on the side of the searches, what we've done is we've looked at the modeling of the PT spectrum of Zs and TT bar pairs as kind of a proxy for how well we're modeling at least the recoil itself, the PT of it. We see some differences, but not terrible. On the other hand, these Monte Carlos aren't generated with exactly the same configuration as our signal, so you can ask how well does it translate. I think we'll continue to do things like that in the future, but in general, we don't have right now an easy way to, I think, exactly translate with the same configuration, the same number of partons in the matrix element from the backgrounds to the signals. And even within this, there's really been much less done on modeling the, checking the modeling, I'd say, of the ISR multiplicity that we rely on when we're far in the tails. I don't have any plots of it. There are some discrepancies seen. We don't model it perfectly. So yeah, I think these are open issues still to study.
Anyone else?
Sorry, just one question. Like, if you go slide 24, for instance, I'm not sure. Yeah, no, exactly. Like, not before. Yeah, when you show the GLUI interfaces. In this case, what do you do? Like, do you always consider it like an off-shell? So do you do like Narrow-width approximation for the intermediate particle, or you do the off-shell, like GLUI decay into three particles?
Right, so the spottom here is heavier than the Gluino, and it's done as what amounts to a three-body decay to BV bar neutralino.
Okay, but if you had other, so do you consider also, like, if you had lighter particles, what?
So in all of these simplified models, what we've done is we basically decouple all the rest of the spectrum except for the particle being produced and whatever the stable particle is at the end of the decay chain.
I see.
So okay. In this case, all of the other squarks, as well as the charginos and everything, are set to some high mass scale, 10 to 100 TeV, so they're completely out of the picture.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else?
Hi, so you focused on searches with missing energy, which I agree are fascinating, but you declined to discuss dark matter at all, mm-hmm. arguing that it essentially is subsumed by the SUSY theories here. Would you then say that the dark matter effort at CMS should be subsumed into the SUSY effort, essentially a waste of time?
I wonder if the SUSY convener wants to come on. No, no. So there, it depends. I mean, if you look at least the results we've put out in the past, I mean, certainly there are quite some differences in approach taken by things like the monojet, which is now a multi-jet search for dark matter, and the way we go about doing these. On the other hand, if you look at some of the other cases of dark matter, BB bar plus MET and TT bar plus MET have actually looked quite a lot like spottom pairs and stop pairs in the past. So, but I think that the two are kind of going in different directions in their approaches, and that's okay. Maybe it's good to have different complementary approaches to looking for these things.
Anyone else? Okay, so I have a question. So you sort of brought this up. Suppose you see a 2.5 sigma excess in 20 of your 170 bins.
Right.
What's your next step?
Right. So suppose we see that. So what can we do about it? Well, I think it depends, because right now, besides trying to figure out if the excess is real or makes sense, or if there even is an excess, trying to quantify it would just completely wipe it out from Lee effects. So the proposal, I don't know if it's official, but the unofficial policy on CMS is basically draw a box around the regions that kind of define the properties of the excess, and then use this subset of regions to define a new search, and you only look in the subset of regions from here on out. The drawback to this is that if you want to quantify the excess in a Lee-free way, most people probably argue then you can't use the data that you took in the first half. But I think this works okay as long as we're sort of at this point in the experiment where the size of the data sets is changing quickly, and losing a few inverse femtobarns isn't that costly. As we collect hundreds of inverse femtobarns, then the approach probably needs to change, because this tactic doesn't work as well.
So here I'm thinking of the 8 TeV CMS multi-lepton search, where there were four high bins,
And so you could say, well, with the 156 exclusive channels in that search, there's no significance. But they were in adjacent bins in the MET distribution, and for a given signal hypothesis, the chance of getting those fluctuations in adjacent bins versus the signal hypothesis actually gave some significance to the same interpretation you have to look elsewhere. So here, similarly, right, you have a signal hypothesis. If it fits all these different bins, you're not going to get killed as much if I look elsewhere. So maybe it's not quite, I mean, once you bin it finely enough, right, this is maybe... it's not obvious that you're going to hit a problem with look elsewhere.
I agree with you. But
in this case, it's very hard to figure out what exactly is LEE dilution because you need to run millions of toys. So it probably would take longer time than for LHC to double the statistics.
The criticism of the CMS approach is slightly overblown, right? And we have evidence for how that's already played out.
It's also hard in general to say, you know, what if you saw something that's very nebulous and then give me a very detailed plan on how you would handle that.
I have to think that in some cases you would also re-examine how your backgrounds were calculated in those regions. For example, you show this case where you're getting a lot from events with three additional ISR jets, and you don't have matrix elements that far out. You said only two additional jets at the matrix element level.
What you say is true on the one hand. On the other hand, there is a difference. The background estimates tend to be much more data-driven, and so we try to normalize away a lot of these effects.
You're right, that was more of a signal.
Where it's more of an issue for the signal, so that comes down more of how we interpret the results once we have them.
Actually, we have the real example where exactly what you're saying has happened. When we saw the excess in multi-leptin channel, we found a missing background, which was asymmetric conversion. So yes, we obviously scrutinize things much more precisely. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fascinating hypothetical, and your suggestion here, I think, is a good one to draw the box around the regions characterizing the excess. The problem is, if you don't know what produced this excess, you don't know whether you're focusing on a statistical fluctuation or the real deal.
Absolutely.
And you have essentially one shot, right, if you're describing this single box. Another approach, which is slightly more nuanced, is to hedge your bets a little bit and have a few sort of nested boxes. I mean, you could zoom in precisely on what the excess is, then you're making a big bet that the rest of the data looks just like that data. And if you're wrong, then you've lost the data. You can generalize one or two or three nested boxes. We had a similar case on Atlas where we saw a bizarre excess, which we then had to understand, and we applied this sort of nested region approach. Of course, since it wasn't a discovery, Atlas didn't let us publish that.
I agree with you. This was to make a very simplified picture of how it is. And when we do this also, you sort of spin this off as a dedicated search. You're still going to keep doing the original thing as well. So.
Anyone else? Okay, if not, let's thank Frank again.
Thanks.